It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. We find out soon if evangelical leaders can still deliver votes in South Carolina. After struggling for months to unite behind a candidate, they met over the weekend and endorsed former Pennsylvania Senator Rick Santorum.
Let's recall Santorum nearly won Iowa, fell far behind in New Hampshire, and is now making his case to conservative voters in South Carolina. Evangelicals hope Santorum will emerge as a strong alternative to Mitt Romney. Some conservatives do not trust Romney, though he is moving rapidly toward the GOP nomination. NPR's Don Gagne has been following Santorum's campaign.
Santorum's Sunday would include a prayer breakfast in Myrtle Beach and a town hall in the town of Florence. But first, thanks to the stamp of approval he got from prominent evangelicals, it was an appearance on Fox News Sunday where he spoke of the endorsement with a mix of pride, gratitude, and validation.
So we feel very, very good that with their support, we're going to get a network of grassroots leaders here lining up behind us and giving us that surge that we need coming down to this last week.
Santorum got just such a surge in Iowa. That one was a product of both hard work and a collapse in the polls by former U.S. House Speaker Newt Gingrich. In South Carolina, polls show Santorum well behind both Romney and Gingrich, and essentially tied with Congressman Ron Paul. But evangelicals make up 60% of the likely GOP primary voters in the state, so he sees an opening. Yesterday afternoon at a restaurant in Florence, Santorum gave it the hard sell. He argued that this election is not all about the economy and the government's fiscal health, as it is often portrayed.
If all you think we need to do to get this economy going and to get this country on the right track is to cut government and reduce taxes, you don't understand America. America is a moral enterprise, not an economic enterprise.
Those words were aimed directly at Mitt Romney, who's running as a businessman with firsthand knowledge of how the economy works. The audience at the Santorum event included hardcore supporters and some new converts. There were also undecided voters, many looking for someone to vote for other than Mitt Romney. In the back of the room were husband and wife Jay and Susan Merrifield. He's leaning towards Santorum over Romney. She just yesterday decided to vote for Santorum over her second choice, Texas Governor Rick Perry. I asked them both if they think the endorsement from evangelical leaders will have much impact in South Carolina.
No, not really. And I'm surprised they didn't pick Perry, really.
It makes me happy, though, because now I'm thinking maybe focus on the family and some of those other shows we'll talk about even on the radio, and more people are here while they're driving and hear Santorum's message.
The potential for Santorum to do well in South Carolina has made him a target of attack ads, this one paid for by a super PAC that supports Romney.
Santorum voted to raise the debt limit 5 times, increasing spending and debt by $3 trillion. And he even voted to let convicted felons vote.
In Florence, Santorum called that ad a lie and the kind of tactic used by a candidate who can't run on his own credentials as a conservative. But Susan Merrifield, the new Santorum supporter, said she's seen a lot worse in a state known for its hardball politics.
I didn't consider it, you know, real bad. I just consider it, well, that's politics and they're going to do it.
Santorum's opponents have plenty of incentive to derail his drive to consolidate the sizable and critical South Carolina evangelical vote. So he'd better be prepared for even more such attacks. Don Gagne, NPR News, Myrtle Beach.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Later in the program, we are going to talk about the kinds of things you could be doing now to get a jump on your taxes. How fun is that? But first, we're going to take a look at what's being called the most important Supreme Court ruling on religious freedom in this country in decades. The case involved Cheryl Parrish. She'd been a teacher at a Lutheran-run school in Michigan. She'd taken some time off due to a medical condition and was not welcome back. She threatened to sue, and the school later fired her. Parrish pressed forward with a lawsuit claiming that her firing violated laws against discrimination. The case eventually made its way to the Supreme Court. Last week, the court sided with the school in a unanimous decision. The ruling asserted that the firing was justified due to a, quote, ministerial exception to laws that ordinarily protect employees from workplace discrimination. We wanted to talk about just what this means, so we've called upon, once again, Eva Rodriguez. She's a Washington Post editorial writer who specializes in legal affairs. She's also a former editor-in-chief of Legal Times. Thanks so much for joining us once again. Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year to you. Thanks.
Just, you know, we're so used to hearing how polarized this court is, especially on hot-button issues. How unusual is it to have a unanimous decision in a case like this?
I think in a case like this, it's rare. I was shocked, to be honest with you, that it was 9-0. I expected those justices who we tend to think of as more liberal to have more trouble, if you will, with granting the church an exception from applying discrimination, retaliation laws. I was shocked.
Well, in fact, the Obama administration had argued that her case should be essentially the same, whether she'd been employed by a church, a labor union, a social club, or any other group with free association rights under the First Amendment. And the reason I'm highlighting the Obama administration here, they didn't bring this case, but they had sided with Cheryl Parrish. And the court did not buy that argument. What did they say?
They didn't buy it at all. They said, dear Mr. President, look at the Constitution, the First Amendment. And while labor unions and churches do enjoy affiliation, that religion is specifically and especially protected under the First Amendment. And so to that extent, something that a church would be protected from, a lawsuit against discrimination, a labor union might very well be vulnerable to that. Religion has a special place in the Constitution. And all nine justices agreed.
Now, tell me about this ministerial exception argument. This is something that critics of the decision are pointing to. Now, she was not an ordained minister, but she had had religious training. I mean, she was called upon to teach religion as one of her subjects, but that took about like 45 minutes out of the school day.
Right.
So tell me more about this ministerial exception and why is that the core of this decision?
Right. It's important to understand, I think, that in the Lutheran church and in Lutheran schools, there are two classes of teachers. A lay teacher, someone who may not even be Lutheran, who is a contract teacher for a year. Maybe you can get extension. And then there are called teachers. These teachers, and Ms. Parrish was one of those, go through special training, religious seminars, and they are called. They are essentially ordained by the church to come and teach. That is a permanent position. And in fact, it's looked upon as, you know, without the title of minister, it is looked upon as a religious leader within the community. And especially when working with kids, you are the person who on a daily basis is bringing forth, you know, teaching the faith to the next generation.
What was the specific action that triggered her firing? And that is, I think, the part that some people are puzzled by.
It's really interesting, and it's not what I would have thought. What triggered her firing was her threat to sue. And the Lutheran Church came back, excuse me, and said, you know, according to our teachings, and they point to 1 Corinthians, every dispute within the church has to be handled within the church. And it's understood that you cannot, you should not go to an outside secular court. And, you know, I'm not a Lutheran. I'd never heard of this. But in fact, it's part of the doctrine. And if we're to respect religious freedom, it may not be something that is part of my church or my synagogue or my mosque, but we have to respect those differences. And that's what the court ultimately said.
Now, there are people like, obviously, the Conference of Catholic Bishops and other large national denominations with a large presence are hailing this ruling as a very important guarantor of their religious rights, religious freedom rights, and the right to practice their religion in the way they see fit. What are some of the critics saying?
The critics are saying, well, if this teacher who didn't have the title of minister, who is not a priest or a rabbi, could be vulnerable to retaliation by the church, who wouldn't be, right? The laws don't apply to the church or to the synagogue or to any religious organization. The court was very clear in saying, look, we're deciding this case very narrowly. We don't know if tomorrow a janitor who worked at the school but is not a Lutheran, is not called, brings a retaliation suit, we may very well let that go. They said, we're not going to make a big sweeping decision here, as important as this is, because we don't know what other permutations are to follow. They're sort of keeping their powder dry.
Now, what about, they're saying as denominations like the Salvation, they didn't say this specifically in the decision, but denominations like the Salvation Army, and for those who don't know, it is in fact a religious denomination, but a majority of the employees who work in the ministries that are so well known around the country are not members of that specific denomination.
Mm-hmm.
They would not be covered. But you're saying a person who is an ordained minister, and that is a term that is specific to some denominations and others, people who fall within, if they have a dispute, they're expected to follow the religious tenets.
Yes.
And that is covered.
Yes. Someone who is specifically tapped, whether the word is ordained or what have you, someone who is tapped by the church and who is looked upon by the church as a religious leader is probably not going to be able to avail themselves of discrimination and retaliation laws that, you know, those who aren't would be.
What if someone were to resign his or her vows, as it were, to renounce his or her vows or to be released from his or her vows?
That's a great question. I don't know. I don't know what happens then. I mean, think about a priest who wants to get married, leaves the church, and then comes back and says, you know, I'm suing you for discrimination because I wanted to get married. He probably wouldn't prevail because, after
all... Or sexual harassment, let's say. There have been a number of, as we mentioned last week, this was the 10th anniversary of the revelation of the sexual abuse scandal or
right.
directed at children in the Boston
right,
Archdiocese,
right.
which is a huge scandal
right.
with, you know, ongoing repercussions.
Right. Well, I think that the court was, it was a little bit opaque here, but fairly clear, that if we're talking about violation of criminal laws, this ministerial exception probably would not apply. If you're a church worker and you're reporting the abuse of a child to law enforcement officials, that in and of itself is not a religious tenet that you're violating, and it will probably be okay for you to go forward. But again, they didn't, you know, talk about this specifically, saying we'll deal with that when and if it arises.
Eva Rodriguez covers legal affairs for The Washington Post. She writes about them for the editorial board. She's also a former editor-in-chief of Legal Times. And she's telling us about the recent Supreme Court ruling that provides an exception to employment discrimination laws in cases involving churches and religious organizations. We're talking about the so-called ministerial exception. This was a rare unanimous ruling by this court. Eva, finally, did any of the people who the sort of commonly described as liberal wing of the court speak out specifically about this? We know that the decision itself was written by the Chief Justice?
Yes.
John Roberts.
John Roberts.
And of course, Associate Justice Clarence Thomas, I believe, also wrote a concurring
right.
opinion.
Right.
Did any of the so-called liberal wing have their own voice
right.
on this? And what did they say if they did?
There was a third opinion here. I mean, again, agreeing with the whole, but Justice Alito with Justice Kagan, President Obama's second nominee to the Supreme Court, joined Justice Alito's concurrence. And what they basically said is, let's not place too much importance on the word minister in the ministerial exception, because after all, there are no ministers in synagogues, in the Jewish religion. There are no ministers specifically in Islam. So let's make clear that you don't have to be a minister going forward to be bound by this. So in a way, Justice Kagan may have even gone a little further than the Chief Justice, the more conservative Chief Justice, went.
And pointing out, Justice Alito added that the concept of ordination should not be at the center of the analysis because,
right.
one, that kind of sacramental authority is conferred in different ways,
right.
according to different faith traditions.
Right.
Should we read anything into the fact that Justice Kagan join Justice Alito in this decision, or specifically to write a concurring opinion?
What struck me was that, A, she joined, you know, a concurrence by one of the most conservative justices on the court, and B, seemed to want to take great care in saying it's not just Christian ministers, right? It would be a whole body of religious leaders who are covered, and they may be called different things, perhaps even at different times. I thought that was interesting. I don't know that I would read way too much into it in terms of, you know, the jurisprudence, but I thought it was interesting that she wanted to be perfectly clear that more than just the Christian, you know, religion and Christian ministers, and those who are ordained would be covered by this.
Eva Rodriguez is an editorial writer with The Washington Post. She specializes in legal affairs, and as we said, she's a former editor-in-chief of Legal Times, and she was kind enough to join us here in our Washington, D.C. studios. Eva, thanks so much for joining us once again.
Thanks for having me.
We want to talk more about faith and spirituality now, and now we want to focus on why so many young Christians seem to be leaving the church. And you might not see it if you look at the sold-out Christian rock or gospel concerts or packed pews at Christmas, but then how do you explain this popular new video? In the last 10 days, Jefferson Bethke's spoken word poem has gotten more than 15 million views on YouTube. We'll play just a short clip of it.
See, the problem with religion is it never gets to the core. It's just behavior modification, like a long list of chores. Like, let's dress up the outside, make it look nice and neat. But it's funny, that's what they used to do to mummies while the corpse rots underneath. Now I ain't judging. I'm just saying, quit putting on a fake look. Because there's a problem if people only know that you're a Christian by your Facebook.
Our next guest says the so-called dropout problem in American Christianity is real. He's written a new book about it. It's called You Lost Me, Why Young Christians Are Leaving Church and Rethinking Faith. David Kinnaman is the author of the book. He's also the president of the Barna Group. That's a private nonpartisan research group that conducted a lot of the research that informed the book. And David Kinnaman is with us now. Welcome. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Michelle. My pleasure.
So the money issue, the money bite here is that more than half of all Christian teens and 20-some things leave active involvement in the church.
Correct. Yeah. So 59% of people who were 18 to 29 who were churched as a teenager said they had dropped out after attending sometime regularly. What's so fascinating is 57% said that they're less active in church, but only 29% said they're less spiritual. So it's interesting because they're less church, they're rejecting institutional forms of church, but they're not necessarily rejecting spirituality.
Now, you say in the book that the ages 18 to 29 are the black hole of church attendance. This age segment is missing in action from most congregations. And that's not because these young folks weren't raised in the church or had some experience with church. It's just there's something's happened after a certain point where they decide to leave. Isn't that kind of dropping out, changing your lifestyle, something that every generation goes through? I guess I'm asking you, why do you think it is there something particularly dramatic about what's happening with this group?
Well, you know, doing this research, it's interesting that you started with the story of that video because we try to capture the voice of this generation through all the interviews that we had done. We did more than 5,000 interviews with teens and 20-somethings and pastors and parents. This is something old, but it's also something new. And as you put it, it's every generation goes through its own spiritual formation process. But what's different now is that this generation is living in a much more complicated time. And because of that, I think this dropout problem is all the more urgent, and we have to pay attention to it and its new nuances.
What are the young people telling you about whether they're taking a break, a temporary break, or dropping out altogether? What are they telling you about why?
What we really boils down to, you know, each person that we interviewed had very specific experiences and challenges, and the church was in some way inadequate in their mind to that. And yet, when we looked at it from a broad perspective, the way I would conclude this is that we're living in a more complicated age, more complicated questions about marriage and the diversity of this generation, the technology use and social media. And in a nutshell, what we learned is that churches aren't really giving them an answer to this complicated questions that they're facing, these lifestyle issues and challenges that they're facing. And it's not really a deep or thoughtful or challenging response that most churches are providing to them.
And are you finding this phenomenon across what people consider liberal and conservative churches, or do you find it concentrated in one side or the other?
Well, one of the surprises for me was I figured that we would see some differences between young Catholics, for instance, and young Protestants and young mainline versus young evangelicals. But I think the overriding theme was that this generation, in so many ways, is post-institutional, regardless of their tradition. So many similarities in their reasons and their reactions to the church and to Christianity. Some of the things that were different was I think many churches that deal well with complexity didn't give a sufficient amount of conviction or commitment required of the young people that they work with. And then conversely, those that had a strong degree of commitment and sort of emotional connection with the church didn't deal well with the complexity. So it was sort of a double-edged sword for many of these churches.
Well, give me an example. Can you just kind of describe one of those conversations that captured this for us?
Sure. Well, I think one of them is a conversation that we had. I mean, I have talked to a young person, Colleen, who was asking her youth pastor whether she should sell her eggs for college. And this is, you know, right at the center of the complexity of today's times because they have instant access to any kind of information available about any kind of thing, you know, theology, religion, faith, human sexuality, reproduction, choices, college, education. They have these huge aspirations to make a difference in the world, to be educated.
Well, what did he say? I mean, what was his answer?
Yeah, he said, you know, I don't think there's one Christian response to that. But he walked her through a process of trying to say, you know, is it necessary for you to go to college? And if so, let's find a way that the church can support you in getting that education.
Well, what's wrong with that, though? I mean, that seems like a loving and both intelligent and affirming response.
It's a great response. The big challenge is that most pastors, most families in churches, they're not prepared for those kinds of questions. I think this young youth pastor did a great job. But I think a lot of questions, as we learn from our research, they're not being asked. In fact, one of the major reasons young people said that they were leaving churches was that they felt like they couldn't ask their most pressing life questions in church. So we heard the question from Colleen, but many of these young people feel like they're so disconnected, they're so entirely disparate worlds, they can't really ask these pressing life questions in church.
Do you have some specific suggestions for faith leaders who are seeing this in their own congregations and want to address it?
We do. I mean, first of all, every congregation is different, and I think there needs to be very customized and thoughtful and deep responses to that. We don't want a one-size-fits-all response. But one of the things I thought was a great concept that we uncovered through the research was this reverse mentoring idea. This generation has the ability to help an older generation, an established generation, many of these traditionalist churches deal effectively with issues of science and social media and gender roles. And yet at the same time, these young people need the input and wisdom of today's older generation. And what's so beautiful about this next generation is they actually really want the wisdom of today's grandparents and elders. And they're facing huge questions, as every generation does, but they're very open to the input of older adults and the wisdom that they could offer. So this idea of reverse mentoring, we need young people to help enliven and invigorate our congregations. And we also need older adults to give good life coaching in the midst of these very different and complicated times that young people are facing.
David Kinnaman is the author of the book, You Lost Me, Why Young Christians Are Leaving Church and Rethinking Faith. And he was kind enough to join us from NPR West in Culver City, California. David Kinnaman, thanks so much for speaking with us.
It's my pleasure. Thanks again for having me.
The final results for Egypt's parliamentary elections are in, and while there are no surprises, the Muslim Brotherhood exceeded expectations by winning 47% of the vote. Another hardline Islamist party, Nur, came in second, with moderate groups trailing far behind. And Pierre's Lourdes Garcia Navarro reports.
The final election results were read out today with little ceremony, but the tally cemented what most people here already know. Islamist groups are the new political powerhouse in post-revolutionary Egypt. Out of the almost 28 million people who voted in these elections, almost half cast their ballots for the Muslim Brotherhood's Freedom and Justice Party. That's a staggering victory for a group that was oppressed and marginalized under former leader Hosni Mubarak. Coming in second with a quarter of the seats is Nur, the new party representing Salafis, hardline Islamists who believe in the segregation of the sexes in public life. That means Islamists will control a whopping 70% of Egypt's lower house of parliament. Coming in third is WAFD, a nationalist party founded in the aftermath of World War I. Many people discounted its electoral clout, but it did relatively well considering. New parties formed after Egypt's revolution fared badly. The Egyptian bloc, representing a union of secular liberal groups, came in fourth. Because no quota system was put in place, women will also have little representation in the lower house of parliament, something that has outraged women's activists here, because less than 2% of parliamentarians will be female. Whether Islamist groups will band together to push through a conservative agenda is still unclear. The Muslim Brotherhood and the Salafis are rivals and not natural bedfellows. But they did already reach an initial power-sharing agreement over who will become the new Speaker of Parliament. The Muslim Brotherhood's FJP, as the new kings of the political scene, have promised, though, to reach out to all the different parties. But the biggest confrontation may not be between the parties at all, but rather between the ruling military junta and the newly empowered groups here. It's not yet clear what authority the parliament will have, and there are indications that the generals running this country won't cede control easily. The new parliament is expected to convene on Monday. Wednesday marks the one-year anniversary of the beginning of the revolution that ultimately toppled Mubarak, and countrywide protests are expected. Lourdes Garcia Navarro, NPR News, Cairo.
This is NPR News.